to frame the issues he wanted to hit in his acceptance speech. When we sat down at the conference table, though, for some reason he was angry. Instead of the policy discussion I was expecting, he launched into a fulmination about how the Democrats were the enemy. He didn't raise his voice, but his speech was so intense and so laced with profanity that it would have made Tony Soprano blush. I was stunned. This was not the man I'd been dealing with. I had no inkling then that I was observing an important part of the Nixon personality. I couldn't understand how a single human being could have such different sides. After a while, he subsided and the meeting went on, but I never looked at him the same way after that. It so disturbed me that after the election, when I was invited to join the White House staff, I said no, I much prefer to go back to my job. Nixon's profane side became public 5 years later with the release of the Watergate tapes, of course. In them, he comes across as an extremely smart man who is sadly paranoid, misanthropic, and cynical. A member of the Clinton administration once was accusing Nixon of anti-Semitism, and I said, "You don't understand. He wasn't exclusively anti-Semitic. He was anti-Semitic, anti-Italian, anti-Greek, anti-Slovak. I don't know anybody he was pro. He hated everybody. He would say awful things about Henry Kissinger, yet he appointed him Secretary of State." When Nixon left office, I was relieved. You didn't know what he might do, and the President of the United States has so much power that it's scary. It's very hard for a military officer sworn to uphold the Constitution to say, "Mr. President, I'm not going to do that." Of course, Nixon was the extreme, but I came to see that people who are on the top of the political heap are really different. Gerry Ford was as close to normal as you get in a president, but he never was elected. There's a constitutional amendment that I've been pushing for years without success. It says, "Anyone willing to do what is required to become President of the United States is thereby barred from taking that office." I'm only half joking. Even though I did not take a permanent job in the administration, Washington became an important part of my life. I worked as interim budget director before the inauguration, helping plan Nixon's first federal budget. I served on task forces and commissions. Most important, the President's Commission on an All-Volunteer Armed Force, which Martin Anderson masterminded, and which paved the way in Congress for the abolition of the draft. Though Anderson assembled the commission, he did not serve on it. It was chaired by Thomas S. Gates, Jr., who had served as Secretary of Defense under Eisenhower. And with friends and professional acquaintances manning many of the government's key economic and domestic policy posts, I found myself spending more and more time inside the Beltway. The economy was behaving erratically, as business grappled with the effects of Vietnam and domestic unrest. A 10% surcharge on the federal income tax, belatedly clamped on under President Johnson and kept in place by Nixon to help pay for the war, wasn't having a healthy effect. In 1970, we slid into a recession that pushed unemployment up to 6%. About 5 million people were out of work. At the same time, inflation seemed to be taking on a life of its own. Instead of dropping, as all the forecasting models said it should, it was running at an annual rate of about 5.7%, low compared with what came later, but disturbingly high by the standard of the day. Under the prevailing Keynesian view of the economy, unemployment and inflation are like kids on a seesaw. When one goes up, the other goes down. To oversimplify, it was argued that the more people there are out of work, the less upward pressure there is on wages and prices. Conversely, when unemployment falls and the labor market gets tight, wage and price increases are likely. But the Keynesian economic models failed to account for the possibility that unemployment and inflation could climb in tandem. This phenomenon, which came to be called stagflation, put policymakers at a loss. The forecasting tools that had made government economists seem so prescient a decade before were in reality not good enough to let the government fine-tune the economy. A poll a few years later showed that the public now rated economists' forecasting ability on a par with that of astrologers. This made me wonder what astrologers had done wrong. The political pressure on the administration to address these problems became intense. Arthur Oaken, who'd been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under Johnson and who was known for his wry sense of humor, invented a discomfort index to describe the dilemma. It was simply the sum of the unemployment rate and the inflation rate. The discomfort index now stood at 10.6%, and since 1965, it had gone nowhere but up. The discomfort index was later renamed the misery index and went on to figure in at least two presidential campaigns. Jimmy Carter used it to criticize President Ford in 1976, and Ronald Reagan used it to criticize President Carter in 1980. I watched as my friends in Washington lurched from one remedy to another. To counter the recession and the chilling effect of the income tax surcharge, the Fed cut interest rates and pumped money into the economy. This helped get GNP growing again, but further fueled inflation. Meanwhile, among some of President Nixon's men, a movement was building for measures that were anathema to us free market economists who had helped Nixon get elected: wage and price controls. Even my old friend and mentor Arthur Burns, whom Nixon appointed Fed chairman in 1970, began talking about something similar: incomes policies. I was stunned by Arthur's reversal. I chalked it up to political exigency combined with whatever alarming developments in the economy he must be seeing from his new vantage. Clearly, the Fed was worried. In retrospect, I suspect Burns was trying to preempt formal wage and price controls. Finally, on Sunday, August 15, 1971, my phone rang at home. It was Herb Stein, who was then a member of Nixon's Council of Economic Advisers. "I'm calling from Camp David," he said. "The president wanted me to tell you he'll be speaking to the nation, and he'll be announcing wage and price controls." That evening is memorable to me for two reasons. First, Nixon preempted Bonanza, America's favorite TV western and a show I love to watch, to announce his policy. And second, I reached for something on the floor and threw my back out. I had to go to bed for 6 weeks. To this day, I like to believe that it was wage and price controls that did me in. I was glad that I wasn't in the government. Burns and his wife were living at the Watergate apartment complex, and sometimes I'd visit their home for dinner. Arthur would muse about the White House's latest initiative and say, "Oh my goodness, what are they thinking of doing now?" After Nixon imposed wage and price controls, I'd fly down to meet with Don Rumsfeld, who was head of the Economic Stabilization Program, the bureaucracy created to administer them. He also ran the Cost of Living Council, where Dick Cheney was his deputy. They asked for my advice because I knew a great deal about how particular industries worked. But all I could do for them was indicate what type of problem would be created by each type of price freeze. What they were running into was the problem of central planning in a market economy. The market will always undermine any attempt at control. One week, the problem was textiles. Because of the political power of the farmers, the administration could not put price caps on raw cotton. So the cotton price was going up. But the government did freeze the price of gray goods, spelled G-R-E-I-G-E, unbleached, undyed, woven cloth that is the first stage in textile production. So the gray goods manufacturers were squeezed. Their costs were going up, but they couldn't raise prices, and companies were abandoning that part of the business. All of a sudden, the fabric finishers and clothing manufacturers were complaining that there weren't enough gray goods. Rumsfeld asked me, "What do I do?" And I said, "Simple, raise the price." Situations like this came up week after week, and after a couple of years, the whole system fell apart. Much later, Nixon said wage and price controls had been his worst policy. But the sad thing was that he knew they were a bad idea all along. It was pure political expediency. A lot of businessmen had said they wanted to freeze wages, and a lot of consumers liked the idea of freezing prices, so he decided he had to do it. The Arab oil embargo of October 1973 only made inflation and unemployment worse, not to mention hurting America's confidence and self-esteem. The consumer price index ballooned. The year 1974 gave rise to the expression double-digit inflation, as the rate went up to a shocking 11%. Unemployment was still at 5.6%. The stock market was in a steep decline. The economy was about to sink into the worst recession since the 1930s, and the Watergate scandal cast a pall over everything. In the middle of all this depressing news, Treasury Secretary Bill Simon called to ask if I would take over as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers. Herb Stein, by then CEA chairman, was getting ready to leave. CEA chairman is one of the three top posts for an economist in Washington, the others being Treasury Secretary and chairman of the Fed. In most circumstances, I would have said yes in a heartbeat. But I didn't agree with many of the president's policies, and hence felt that I would not be able to function effectively. I told Simon I was honored, and that I'd be happy to suggest other candidates, but my answer was no. He called a second time a week or so later, and I said, Bill, I appreciate it, but I really mean it. Well, would you at least go talk to Al Haig? Haig was President Nixon's chief of staff. I agreed, and a day later, Haig asked if I'd come to see him at Key Biscayne, Florida, where the president liked to spend time. Haig really put on the White House show of interest, sending a military executive jet, complete with a steward, to shuttle me down to Key Biscayne. When I arrived, Haig and I had a long talk. I told him, "You're making a mistake. If I come in as chairman and the administration starts implementing policies I can't agree with, I'd have to resign. You don't need that." Wage and price controls had mostly been lifted by this time, but there was a lot of pressure from Congress to reimpose them because of inflation. I told him I would have to resign if that happened. Haig said, "That's not the direction we're heading. You won't feel the need to resign." As I got ready to leave, he asked, "Do you want to see him?" He meant Nixon. I said, "I don't see any reason." The truth was that I still felt very uncomfortable with the man. I wasn't sure about the job offer either, and I felt the hardest thing in the world would be to say no to the President of the United States. I'd barely returned to my office in New York when the phone rang again. This time, it was Arthur Burns. He asked me to come to see him in Washington, which I did. That was my mistake. My old mentor puffed on his pipe and played on my guilt. Referring to the Watergate scandal, he said, "This government is paralyzed, but there's still an economy out there, and we still have to make economic policy. You owe it to your country to serve." Besides, he pointed out, I'd been building Townsend Greenspan for 20 years. Wasn't it time to see if the company could fend for itself? By the end of the conversation, I was persuaded that maybe I could do something useful in Washington. But I told myself I'd take an apartment on a month-to-month lease, and figuratively at least, keep a suitcase packed by the door. If Nixon hadn't been in such trouble, I doubt I'd have taken the job. I viewed it almost as a caretaker position to help hold things together. I expected to be there a relatively short time. If Nixon had somehow continued in office through the end of his term, I would probably not have stayed more than a year. But events took a radically different turn. My Senate confirmation hearing was on the afternoon of Thursday, August 8, 1974. That very evening, Nixon went on TV to announce his resignation. I'd met Vice President Ford only once, for an hour-long conversation about the economy a few weeks before. But we'd gotten along well, and on the urging of Don Rumsfeld, who headed his transition team, he reaffirmed Nixon's appointment of me. The Council of Economic Advisers is essentially a small consulting firm with a single client, the President of the United States. It has rooms in the old executive office building across the street from the White House, and consists of 3 council members and a small staff of economists, mostly professors on 1 or 2 year leave from their universities. Under Nixon, the CEA had become quite political, with Herb Stein frequently speaking on the president's behalf. Though Herb was an effective chairman, it is very difficult to be both an advisor and a spokesman. Normally, it is the Treasury Secretary who is the economic spokesman for the administration, and I wanted to return the council to its advisory role. After discussing this briefly with the other council members, William Fellner and Gary Sievers, I canceled the regular monthly press briefings. I decided I would make as few speeches as possible and as few congressional contacts as necessary. Of course, I'd have to give testimony when called upon. As chairman, I was an unusual choice, because I didn't yet have a PhD, and because I looked at the economy differently from most academicians. At Townsend Greenspan, we had computers and state-of-the-art econometric models that any professor would recognize, but our focus was always industry-level analysis, not macro variables such as unemployment and federal deficits. Ford and Nixon were as different as day and night. Ford was a secure man, with fewer psychological hang-ups than almost anyone I'd ever met. You never got strange vibes from him, never any sense of hidden motives. If he was angry, he'd be angry for an objective reason. But that was rare. He was exceptionally even-tempered. In 1975, just after the fall of Saigon, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia seized the Mayaguez, a U.S.-flagged container ship in a shipping lane off their coast. I was sitting next to Ford in an economics meeting when Brent Scowcroft, the deputy director of the National Security Council, came in and put a note in front of him. The president opened it up. He read it. This was the first Ford had learned of the incident. He turned to Scowcroft and said, "Okay, provided that we do not shoot first." Then he turned back to the meeting and continued the discussion. I never read the note, but it was clear that the president had just authorized the military to shoot back, if necessary, against the Khmer Rouge forces. He always understood what he knew and what he didn't know. He didn't think he was intellectually superior to Henry Kissinger or that he knew more about foreign policy, but he wasn't intimidated. Ford was secure in himself, probably one of those rare people who would actually score normal in psychological tests. Though he wasn't terribly articulate on the subject of economics, I found that President Ford had a sophisticated and consistent outlook on economic policy. Years on the House Appropriations Committee had taught him everything there is to know about the federal budget, and his budgets as president were truly his own. More important, he believed in restraint in federal spending, a balanced budget, and stable long-term growth. Ford's top priority was to develop a solution to inflation, which in his first address to Congress he identified as public enemy number one. With the dollar losing more than 10% of its purchasing power that year, inflation had everybody spooked. People cut back on spending because they worried about making ends meet. In businesses, inflation creates uncertainty and risk, which makes planning more difficult and discourages managers from hiring or building factories or indeed doing any kind of investing for growth. That's what happened in 1974. Capital spending essentially froze, making the recession far more severe. I agreed with the president's priorities, but I was horrified to learn how his White House staff planned to tackle the issue. My first experience of policymaking in the Roosevelt Room of the White House almost sent me racing back to New York. It was a senior staff meeting at which the speechwriting department unveiled a campaign called Whip Inflation Now. WIN, as they wanted it to be known, get it, one asked, was a vast program that would involve a national voluntary price freeze, a summit conference in Washington in October to discuss inflation, with preliminary task forces and mini-summits all over the country, and many other features. The speechwriters had ordered up millions of Whip Inflation Now buttons, samples of which they handed out to us in the room. It was surreal. I was the only economist present, and I said to myself, "This is unbelievable stupidity. What am I doing here?" Because I was new, I wasn't sure of the protocol. I didn't think I should just say what I thought. So I zeroed in on things that made no economic sense. I pointed out, "You can't ask small business owners to voluntarily forgo price increases. These people operate on thin margins, and they can't prevent their suppliers from raising prices." Over the next few days, I succeeded in getting them to water down a few of the provisions. But Whip Inflation Now went forward with great fanfare that fall. It was a low point of economic policymaking. It made me glad I'd canceled the CEA's press briefings, because I was never called upon in public to defend Whip Inflation Now. By the end of the year, it was totally eclipsed by the worsening recession. The main economic policy group at the White House met each workday at 8:30 a.m., and since the economy was at center stage politically, everybody wanted to participate. The group included five or six cabinet officers, the director of the budget, the so-called energy czar, and more. On key issues, Arthur Burns would sit in to advise. Many days there would be 25 people in the room. This was a good forum in which to air issues, but not a place to make the real decisions. The inner circle of economic advisors was much smaller. Treasury Secretary Simon, Budget Director Roy Ash, later his successor Jim Lynn, Arthur Burns, and me. At first, it seemed as though all any of us did was bring the president bad news. In late September, unemployment suddenly ticked up. Soon, orders, production, and employment all started to fall. By Thanksgiving, I was telling the president, "There's a possibility that we may have very severe problems going into next spring." On Christmas Eve, the policy group wrote a memorandum warning him to expect more unemployment and the deepest recession since World War II. It was not a nice present. Worse, we had to tell him we didn't know how bad the recession would be. Recessions are like hurricanes. They range from ordinary to catastrophic. The ordinary ones are part of the business cycle. They happen when business inventories exceed demand, and companies cut production sharply until the excess inventory gets sold. The Category 5 kind happens when demand itself collapses, when consumers stop spending and businesses stop investing. As we talked through the possibilities, President Ford worried that America would find itself trapped in a vicious cycle of falling demand, layoffs, and gloom. Since none of the forecasting models could deal with the circumstances we were facing, we were flying blind. All we could tell him was that this might be an inventory-based recession, aggravated by the oil shock and inflation, maybe a Category 2 or 3, or it might be a Category 5. The president had to make a choice. With the discomfort index nearing 20%, there was tremendous political pressure from Congress to slash taxes or massively pump up government spending. That was the way to deal with a Category 5. It could revive growth in the short term, though it risked pushing inflation even higher, with potentially disastrous long-term effects. On the other hand, if we were facing only an inventory recession, the optimum response, economically, not politically, was to do as little as possible. If we could keep our hand off the panic button, the economy would correct itself. Ford was not a man given to panic. In early January 1975, he instructed us to develop the mildest possible plan. It ended up including steps to ease the energy crisis, restraints on federal budget growth, and a one-time income tax rebate to give families a boost. The rebate was the brainchild of Andrew Brimmer, a private sector economist who'd served in the LBJ years as the first African-American governor of the Federal Reserve Board. A few days before presenting the plan to the public, President Ford quizzed me closely on whether a $16 billion tax rebate would hurt our prospects for long-term growth. Economically speaking, the rebate was a prudent response, I told him, and explained, as long as it's a one-shot deal and doesn't become permanent, it's not going to do much harm. I was a little startled when he answered, if that's what you think should be done, then I'll propose it. Of course, he was also consulting with advisors more senior than I, but I thought, this is interesting. The President of the United States is taking my advice. I felt a big sense of responsibility and gratification. Ford didn't owe me anything, politically or otherwise. Here was proof that ideas and facts did matter. His restrained program made good economic sense. It jibed with my own decision-making philosophy. In reviewing a policy, I always asked myself the question, what are the costs to the economy if we are wrong? If there is no downside risk, you can try any policy you want. If the cost of failure is potentially very large, you should avoid the policy, even if the probability of success is better than 50-50, because you cannot accept the cost of failure. All the same, the choice President Ford made took a lot of political courage. He was well aware that his program would be denounced as inadequate, and that it might, if it proved too mild, prolong the economic slide. I decided the CEA had to treat this as an emergency. The president needed to know whether we were facing a temporary inventory shock or a major meltdown of demand. The only surefire economic measure of that was the gross national product, a comprehensive description of the economy that the Bureau of Economic Analysis derived from a vast agglomeration of statistics. Unfortunately, the BEA produced the GNP only once per quarter, well after the fact, and you can't drive using a rearview mirror. My idea was to rig up an emergency set of headlights, a weekly version of the GNP that would enable us to monitor the recession in real time. I believed this was possible because at Townsend Greenspan we'd developed a monthly GNP. It appealed to clients who had to make decisions and did not want to wait for the official quarterly figures to be announced. So the analytical foundation was there. Creating a weekly measure would mostly mean more work. Some crucial statistics, such as retail sales and new unemployment insurance claims, were already available on a weekly basis, so those were easy. Other key data, such as auto sales or statistics on orders and shipments of durable goods, factory gear, computers, and so on, were normally reported every 10 days or once a month. Inventory data, too, were monthly, with the further complication that the surveys were often inaccurate and subject to large revisions. A way to fill these giant information gaps was to get on the phone. I'd built a large network of clients and contacts over the years in companies, trade associations, universities, and regulatory agencies, and many of these people responded generously when we called to ask for help. Companies shared confidential information about their order books and hiring plans. Business leaders and experts guided us with their own observations and insights. We were able to build a clearer picture of inventories, for example, By combining this anecdotal information with sensitive measures of raw materials prices, imports and exports, delivery schedules, and more. The evidence we pulled together was still fragmentary, nowhere near the standard that the Bureau of Economic Analysis used in calculating GNP for public dissemination. But it fit our special needs. When the BEA economists and statisticians learned what we were trying to do, they pitched in and helped us structure our analysis. After 2 or 3 weeks of burning the midnight oil, our small staff was also busy preparing its annual assessment of the economy, which is published in early February, the weekly GNP system was up and running. Finally, I was able to start going to President Ford with up-to-date facts instead of guesstimates. The policy issues came into much sharper focus after that. Each week, at the regular cabinet meeting, I would update the picture of the recession. As we looked at the 10-day auto sales figures, the weekly retail sales, the data on housing permits and starts, detailed reports coming out of the unemployment insurance system, and so on, we became convinced that this was the milder kind of storm. Consumers, it turned out, were still buying at a healthy rate despite all they'd been through. What was more, inventories were being liquidated at a very rapid clip, a pace that could not continue for long, or business would soon run out of inventories. This meant production soon had to rise to close the gap with consumption. Thus, I was able to tell the President and the Cabinet that the recession was bottoming out. I said, with what for me was certainty, "I can't give you the exact date, but unless there is a collapse in consumer markets or housing, it's got to happen that way." Week after week, the data were unequivocal. It turned out to be one of those rare, fortunate occasions in economics when the facts are clear and you can know for sure what is going on. So when the time came in March 1975 for me to testify in Congress, I had the strong conviction necessary to be able to say that America was moving toward a recovery on schedule. I testified that we faced another bad quarter and that unemployment could hit 9%, and yet it was now possible to be marginally optimistic. And I warned against panicky spending increases or tax cuts that would overstimulate the economy and trigger another inflationary spiral. The political storm surrounding the President's economic plan that spring was something to behold. There was tremendous fear in Congress. I used to joke that I had to put on my bulletproof vest and armor when I'd go up to the Hill to testify. Newsweek put my picture on the cover in February 1975 under the headline, "How Far Is Down?" Congressman Henry Roos thought Ford, like Herbert Hoover in 1930, would let us slide into a depression and was quoted saying, "The President is getting the same kind of economic advice that Herbert Hoover was given." When I appeared before the Senate Budget Committee, the chairman, Ed Muskie, asserted that the administration was doing too little too late. Congressmen were putting forward proposals to stimulate the economy that would have pushed the deficit to $80 billion and beyond, a horrendous figure at the time. George Meany, the president of the AFL-CIO, was even more vociferous. "America is in the worst economic emergency since the Great Depression," he testified. "The situation is frightening now, and it is growing more ominous by the day. This is not just another recession, for it has no parallel in the 5 recessions in the post-World War II period. America is far beyond the point where the situation can correct itself. Massive government action is needed." Meany wanted the government to run a $100 billion deficit, including massive tax cuts for low- and middle-income families, to stimulate growth. One thing that surprised everyone was the lack of public protest. Coming off a decade of civil rights and anti-Vietnam War marches, anyone who could have foreseen 9% unemployment would have expected massive demonstrations and barricades in the streets, not just in the United States, but also in Europe and Japan, where the economic problems were equally severe. Yet that didn't happen. Perhaps the world was simply exhausted by the oil shock and the decade that had led up to it, but the era of protest was over. America was going through this period with what seemed like a new sense of cohesion. President Ford held off the pressure, and his economic program eventually made it into law. Congress did raise the tax rebate by almost 50% to about $125 per average household. More important, the recovery began when we promised the public it would, in mid-1975. GNP growth rocketed. By October, the economy was expanding at the highest rate in 25 years. Inflation and unemployment began slowly to abate. As is so often the case, the hyperbole not only ceased virtually overnight, but also the frightening predictions were quickly forgotten. In July, the crisis having passed, we retired our emergency weekly GNP monitoring program, much to the relief of the CEA staff. Deregulation was the Ford administration's great unsung achievement. It's difficult to imagine how straitjacketed American business was then. Airlines, trucking, railroads, buses, pipelines, telephones, television, stockbrokers, financial markets, savings banks, utilities, all operated under heavy regulation. Operations were monitored down to the tiniest detail. My favorite description of this was by Alfred Kahn, a wisecracking economist from Cornell University, whom Jimmy Carter made head of the Civil Aeronautics Board, and who became known as the father of airline deregulation. Speaking in 1978 on the need for change, Fred couldn't resist riffing on the thousands of picayune decisions he and the board were called upon to make. May an air taxi acquire a 50-seat plane? May a supplemental carrier carry horses from Florida to somewhere in the Northeast? Should we let a scheduled carrier pick up stranded charter customers and carry them on seats that would otherwise be empty at charter rates? May a carrier introduce a special fare for skiers but refund the cost of their ticket if there is no snow? May the employees of two financially affiliated airlines wear similar-looking uniforms? Then he looked at the congressman and said, "Is it any wonder that I ask myself every day, is this action necessary? Is this what my mother raised me to do?" President Ford launched his campaign to eliminate such folly in a speech in Chicago in August 1975. He promised a business audience that he would take the shackles off American businessmen and get the federal government as far out of your business, out of your lives, out of your pocketbooks, and out of your hair as I possibly can. The choice of Chicago seemed fitting. Deregulation's economic rationale came primarily from Milton Friedman and the other mavericks of the so-called Chicago School. These economists had built a large, impressive body of work around the theory that markets and prices, not central planners, were the best allocators of society's resources. The Keynesian presumption that had held sway in Washington since the Kennedy administration was that the economy could be actively managed. The Chicago economists argued that government should intervene less, not more, because scientific regulation was a myth. Now, after years of stagflation and with the failure of wage and price controls fresh in people's minds, politicians on both sides were ready to agree that micromanagement by government had gone too far. It was time to do less. In fact, a remarkable consensus on economic policy emerged in Washington, a convergence of attitudes between the liberal left and the conservative right. Suddenly, everybody was looking to restrain inflation, cut deficit spending, reduce regulation, and encourage investment. Ford's deregulation campaign initially targeted railroads, trucking, and airlines, and despite massive opposition by companies and unions, within a few years, Congress deregulated all three. It's hard to overemphasize how important Ford's deregulation was. True, most of the benefits took years to unfold. Rail freight rates, for example, hardly budged at first. Yet deregulation set the stage for an enormous wave of creative destruction in the 1980s, the breakup of AT&T and other dinosaurs, the birth of new industries such as personal computing and overnight shipping, the mergers and acquisitions boom on Wall Street, and the remaking of companies would be the hallmarks of the Reagan era. And, we would ultimately find, deregulation also greatly increased the economy's flexibility and resilience. Jerry Ford and I grew very close. He was consistent in his view that what the economy most needed was a return of confidence and cool. This meant staying away from the aggressive interventionism that started under Kennedy and from the abrupt, politically reactive policymaking that made the nation so panicky and uncertain under Nixon. Ford wanted to slow the pace of policy action, simmer down the deficit and inflation and unemployment, and eventually achieve a stable, balanced, steadily growing economy. Since these were very much my views, too, it became easy for the CEA to function. We didn't have to keep checking to find out what he thought. We could boil down a problem to a set of options, and then I could pick up the phone and say, "We've got this issue. Here are the choices. How would you like to proceed? 1, 2, 3, or 4? We could have a 3-minute conversation, and I'd come away with very clear instructions on what he wanted to do. Being at the center of things was admittedly fun. In January 1976, I was helping Jim Lynn draft the economics section of the President's State of the Union speech. Things were changing very rapidly, and we were rewriting up to the last minute. One night, we were working late at the White House making revisions, a tedious chore because there were no word processors. And Jim said, "I wonder how I'll feel after I leave. Maybe I'll be outside this building with my nose pressed against the glass, wondering what all these powerful people are doing." We burst out laughing. Sure, we were working with scissors and tape and whiteout, but we were writing the State of the Union address. The White House was also great for my tennis game. I hadn't played since I was a teenager, but after the weather warmed up and the crisis cooled down, I started again from scratch on the White House tennis court. The court is outdoors, near the southwest gate, and its great advantage is that it's thoroughly concealed by fences. My opponent was Frank Zarb, the energy czar, who hadn't played tennis in a long time either, so we were very fortunate no one could see. I was back and forth to New York every Saturday or Sunday. I'd water the plants in my apartment and spend time with my mother. These trips did not involve business. To satisfy conflict of interest rules, I'd removed myself entirely from the operations of Townsend Greenspan and put my ownership into a blind trust. The company was in the hands of my vice presidents, Kathy Eikoff, Bess Kaplan, and Lucille Wu, and former Vice President Judith Mackey, who had come back temporarily to help out. Townsend Greenspan was unusual for an economics firm in that the men worked for the women. We had about 25 employees in all. My hiring of women economists was not motivated by women's liberation. It just made great business sense. I valued men and women equally and found that because other employers did not, good women economists were less expensive than men. Hiring women did two things. It gave Townsend Greenspan higher quality work for the same money, and it marginally raised the market value of women. I always brought along some CEA work on the weekends. During the week, I generally worked 10 to 12-hour days. I followed a very satisfying routine, starting with a long, hot bath at dawn. This habit began after I'd thrown out my back in 1971. As part of the rehab process, my orthopedist had recommended soaking in a hot bath for an hour each morning. I found I liked it. It was an ideal environment for work. I could read, I could write, and it was perfectly private. I could get white noise by turning on the exhaust fan. My back eventually healed, but by then the bath was an activity of choice. I'd be out the door by 7:30 a.m., and my apartment at the Watergate was close enough to the old executive office building for me to walk to work on occasion. The streets around the White House were much more placid than they'd been in the Nixon administration, when during visits to the city I'd often had to thread my way through protesters. My routine was much like that of anybody immersed in public life. The White House staff met at 8, and the Economic Policy Board at 8:30, and the day would go on from there. I'd usually work until 7, with breaks for tennis or occasionally golf. The president would periodically invite me to play golf with them at Burning Tree, a suburban Washington country club that became notorious for excluding women. Today, no president could do that, but few people complained in the early 1970s. I'd go to dinner or to a concert, often sitting in the president's box, or make an appearance at a reception. I took no real days off, but I didn't mind. I was doing what I loved. The economic recovery greatly boosted Ford's chances of getting elected in 1976. Given the public's sour memories of Watergate, the pardon of Nixon, inflation, and OPEC, many pundits started out saying it was virtually impossible for Ford or any Republican to win. Before the summer's party conventions, polls had him trailing by more than 30 percentage points. But Ford's prudence and even-handedness, and his results, were winning respect, and the gap soon narrowed. I'd have been interested in a job in his new administration. In spite of my early skepticism about working in government, I'd become convinced that it was sometimes possible to do good in Washington. I would have loved a chance to serve as Treasury Secretary. But when asked early on if I wanted to be in his campaign, I said I did not. I thought it inappropriate for a CEA chairman. Certain officers of the government, the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the CEA chairman, should not, I felt, be involved in electoral politics, because they run institutions that are supposed to generate information of a bipartisan nature. The president thought I'd made the right call. Nevertheless, as Ford got ready to square off against Jimmy Carter, I inadvertently supplied the buzzword that was used against the president throughout the campaign. The central economic debate of Campaign 76 was whether the recovery had collapsed. After growing extremely rapidly through the first quarter of the year, at a tiger-like annual rate of 9.3%, the economy had abruptly cooled to a growth rate of less than 2% by summer. From an economist's standpoint, this was not a cause for concern, because a modern economy involves so many moving parts, it rarely accelerates or decelerates smoothly, and in this case, all the other major indicators, inflation, unemployment, and so on, looked fine. I laid this out in a cabinet meeting in August, using charts to demonstrate how this recovery mirrored past ones. The pattern is advance and pause, I told them. We are in one of those pause periods, but the basic recovery is solidly in place, with no evidence of underlying deterioration. Those remarks, relayed by Press Secretary Ron Nessen to the media, turned out to be red meat for the president's critics. To them, pause was an administration euphemism for "we failed." Suddenly, the debate of early 1975 reignited, and Ford was again under tremendous pressure, from Congress and even his own campaign team, to abandon his commitment to a long-term, sustainable recovery and pull out the stops on economic stimulus. In the presidential debate that October, columnist Joseph Kraft asked bluntly, "Mr. President, the country is now in something that your advisors call an economic pause. I think to most Americans that sounds like an antiseptic term for low growth, unemployment, standstill at a high level, decline in take-home pay, lower factory earnings, more layoffs. Isn't that a really rotten record, and doesn't your administration bear most of the blame for it?" Ford stoically defended his achievement, and history proved him right. Economic growth went on to accelerate for another full year. But by the time this became apparent, Election Day had come and gone, and Ford had lost narrowly to Jimmy Carter, by little more than 1.5 million votes. Years afterward, Henry Kissinger used to tease me, "You were right about the pause. It's just too bad it happened to coincide with a presidential election." On January 20, 1977, Jimmy Carter was inaugurated as the 39th President of the United States. As he stood in front of the Capitol and took the oath of office, I was on the noon shuttle on my way back to New York. Chapter 4. Private Citizen. It's never easy being on the losing side. Still, I found plenty of reasons to be glad to come home to New York. The services of Townsend Greenspan were more in demand than ever. All kinds of doors opened to me, and I accepted as many interesting commitments as the calendar would allow. I rejoined Time Magazine's Board of Economists and the Brookings Panel on Economic Activity, with people like Walter Heller, Martin Feldstein, George Perry, and Arthur Oaken. I stepped up my speech-making, appearing two or three times a month before companies, management groups, and associations, mostly to talk about their businesses and the economic outlook. I also found myself in demand as a corporate director, joining the boards of Alcoa, Mobil, J.P. Morgan, General Foods, Capital Cities ABC, and more. People serve on Fortune 500 boards for lots of reasons, but the primary reason for me was that being a director gave me a chance to learn the economic workings of things that are familiar, but that I've never fully understood, like Cool Whip and Post Toasties. Until I became a director at General Foods, I never knew how the processed food business worked. Townsend Greenspan had done a lot of analysis of wheat, corn, and soybeans, but never of the foods you see in commercials and on supermarket shelves. For instance, General Foods owned Maxwell House, a dominant brand of coffee in those days, before people were mesmerized by Starbucks. I was amazed to learn, though it made sense once I thought about it, that the main competitors for Maxwell House were not only other coffees, but also soda and beer. The marketers were competing for a share of the nation's stomach capacity. General Foods also made me feel close to business history. The company still bore the stamp of its founder, the heiress Marjorie Merriweather Post. She'd been only 27 when her father died and left her in charge of the family business, the Postum Cereal Company. With the second of her four husbands, the Wall Street financier E.F. Hutton, she built Postum into General Foods. She died just a few years before I joined the board, but their only child, the actress Dina Merrill, was a real presence at the company. After all the years I'd spent studying business economics, it was still hard to fathom how big some of these companies were. Mobile, which in 1977 had $26 billion in sales and ranked number 5 on the Fortune 500, was operating everywhere, in the North Sea, in the Middle East, in Australia, in Nigeria. I gave a toast at my first dinner with the other directors that included a joke only an economist could appreciate. "I feel right at home here. Mobile is on the same order of magnitude as the U.S. government. The number 0.1 on a financial statement means $100 million. Among all the boards I joined, J.P. Morgan's was the one that I found most engaging. It was the holding company for Morgan Guaranty, arguably then the world's premier bank. The board was a roll call of America's business elite. Frank Carey of IBM, Walter Fallon of Eastman Kodak, John Dorrance of Campbell Soup, Louis Foy of Bethlehem Steel, and me. We would meet at 23 Wall Street, which J.P. Morgan himself had built in the era when he reigned over American finance. On the fortress-like facade, you could still see the pockmarks from the terrorist bombing of 1920, when in the middle of a busy day, a horse-drawn wagon of dynamite and shrapnel was set off in front of the bank, killing and injuring dozens of people. The bombing was attributed to anarchists, but was never solved. Inside, the company had preserved the decor, with its high ceilings and roll-top desks. The first time I sat in that boardroom, I felt a little intimidated. There was a portrait of J.P. Morgan on the wall above the board table, and where I happened to be seated, when I raised my head, he was looking right at me. You might have expected the people running Morgan to be loaded with pedigrees and manners. Instead, the business was a meritocracy. A good example was Dennis Weatherstone, who rose to CEO in the 1980s. Dennis never went to university. He started right out of a polytechnic school as a trader in Morgan's London branch. His success was hardly a result of social connections, because he didn't have any. Being on the Morgan board was a wonderful opportunity to learn the inner workings of international finance. It puzzled me, for example, that month after month the bank consistently showed a profit on currency trading. I knew that because of the efficiency of foreign exchange markets, forecasting exchange rates for major currencies is as accurate as forecasting the outcome of the flip of a coin. Finally, I confronted the management. "Look, gentlemen, all the studies I'm aware of say you can't make profits consistently in foreign exchange." "That's true," they explained. "But it's not forecasting that makes us money. We're market makers. We collect on the spread between the bid and the ask, no matter which way rates move." Like eBay today, they were taking a small cut on every transaction in which they served as middleman, and they were doing it on a vast scale. One of the people on J.P. Morgan's International Advisory Council was a Saudi billionaire named Suleiman Olayan. He was an entrepreneur a few years older than I, who'd gotten his start driving trucks for the Arabian American Oil Company, Aramco, in the 1940s. Pretty soon he'd spun that off into a business that sold water, among other things, to the drillers and provided other services. From there he diversified into construction and manufacturing. He was also the man who had introduced insurance into the kingdom. He was already enormously wealthy when Saudi Arabia nationalized Aramco and took control of its own oil. And with the rise of OPEC, he developed a taste for American banks. He'd bought 1% of the stock not only in J.P. Morgan, but also in Chase Manhattan, Mellon, Bankers Trust, and four or five other big names. I got a kick out of him and his wife Mary, an American who'd been working for Aramco when they met. Olayan was even more of a sponge for information than I. He was forever asking me questions about different aspects of the American economy. I never asked him about it. But later it occurred to me that being on the Morgan Council may have given him a better feel for the flows of petrodollars. A major business for U.S. banks in those days was taking in vast deposits of profits from Saudi Arabia and other OPEC nations and looking for places, mainly in Latin America, to lend the money out. OPEC didn't want to take on the risks of investing its surplus. The banks, to their eventual sorrow, did. Returning to New York from the Ford administration, I continued dating Barbara Walters, whom I had met in 1975 while I was in Washington, at a tea dance given by Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. The following spring, I'd helped her think through a difficult and very high-profile career decision, whether to leave NBC's Today Show, where she had worked for 12 years, rising to become a hugely popular co-host, and join ABC News, where she would be TV's first evening news anchorwoman. To entice her, ABC was offering a record-breaking salary of $1 million a year, and as everyone knows, she finally opted to make the move. I'm not threatened by a powerful woman. In fact, I'm now married to one. The most boring activity I could imagine was going out with a vacuous date, something I learned the hard way over my years as a bachelor. Before getting to know Barbara, a typical evening for me would be a professional dinner with other economists. Barbara, however, interacted constantly with news, sports, media, and entertainment personalities, interviewing a tremendous range of people, from Judy Garland to Mamie Eisenhower, from Richard Nixon to Anwar Sadat. She also had show business roots. Her father, Lou, had been a big-time nightclub owner and Broadway producer. His Latin Quarter clubs in Manhattan and Miami Beach were the 1950s equivalent of the Stork Club of the 1930s, or more to the point by this time, the disco era's Studio 54. During the several years we dated and afterward, we remained good friends, I escorted Barbara to lots of parties where I met people I otherwise would never have encountered. I usually thought the food was good, but the conversation dull. Of course, they probably thought the same about me. Business economists are not exactly party animals. Even so, I did build up a wonderful circle of friends. Barbara threw me a 50th birthday party at her house. The guests were the people I'd come to think of as my New York friends: Henry and Nancy Kissinger, Oscar and Annette De La Renta, Felix and Liz Rowerton, Brooke Astor, I knew her as a kid of 75, Joe and Estée Lauder, Henry and Louise Grunwald, Punch and Carol Sulzberger, and David Rockefeller. I'm still friends with many of these people today, more than 30 years later. Barbara's social network extended to Hollywood, of course. Business would take me to Los Angeles 5 or 6 times a year, where I'd play golf at the Hillcrest Country Club, the place where Jack Benny, Groucho Marx, Henny Youngman, and other comedians used to have a round table every day at lunch. Ronald Reagan was also a Hillcrest member. I learned a bit about the media industry doing work for the William Morris Agency, which was a Townsend Greenspan client, and from spending time with the legendary producer Lou Wasserman. And I'd tag along with Barbara to parties in Beverly Hills, where I felt totally out of place. I'll never forget the moment when Sue Mengers came up to me at a party she was throwing for Jack Nicholson and gave me a hug. She was by far the most powerful agent in Hollywood, representing stars like Barbara Streisand, Steve McQueen, Gene Hackman, and Michael Caine. "I know you don't remember me," she began. Then she explained how when I was 15 and she was 13, we used to hang out with other Washington Heights kids on the wall of Riverside Park. "You never noticed me, but I always looked up to you," she said. I was as speechless as I probably would have been at age 15. Diverting as all this was, I still kept an eye on Washington. Jimmy Carter had no use for me. We met on only a couple of occasions and never hit it off. Of course, I'd been part of the Ford administration, and he'd defeated Ford. But from the sidelines in New York, I saw much going on in government to cheer about. Many of the moves that the administration and Congress made were the very ones I'd have pushed for had I been there. Most important, the Carter administration carried on the deregulation initiative that had begun under Jerry Ford. The airline deregulation bill, promoted by Ted Kennedy, passed in 1978. Kennedy's right-hand man on this project was Stephen Breyer, who was on leave from Harvard Law School and who later became a justice of the Supreme Court and a good friend. After that, Congress moved methodically to deregulate telecommunications and a half dozen other industries. Deregulation had a lasting effect not just on the economy, but also on the Democratic Party, ending its domination by labor and opening it to business. But as important as these changes were, President Carter got little credit for them, mainly because of his style. Unlike Reagan, who knew how to present economic renewal stirringly, Carter came across as hesitant and dispirited. He made change seem like something you did because you had no choice. The economy did not work in Carter's favor. For a year or so, his administration enjoyed the benefits of the recovery that had started under Ford. Then growth slowed, and inflation resumed a steady and ominous rise. It cast a continuing pall of uncertainty on wage negotiations and investment decisions. It affected the rest of the world, too, because other countries depended on the stability of the dollar, and the dollar was weakening. Throughout 1978, inflation ratcheted up, from 6.8% at the beginning of the year to 7.4% in June to 9% by Christmas. Then in January 1979, Islamic fundamentalists overthrew the Shah of Iran and the second oil crisis began. As gas lines formed that summer owing to gasoline price controls, the economy started to spiral toward another recession and inflation crossed again into the double-digit range, hitting 12% by fall. It's not that Carter didn't try. His administration proposed no fewer than 7 economic programs, but none was strong enough to contain what was fast becoming a crisis. From talking to my friends and professional contacts in the administration, I thought I understood their problem. Carter felt compelled to be all things to all people, so he'd propose new social programs while simultaneously trying to reduce the deficit, lower unemployment, and cut inflation. Among all those largely incompatible goals, controlling inflation was the one most fundamental to long-term prosperity. Under Carter, it never got the priority it deserved. That was the analysis I gave to the New York Times in early 1980. I contrasted Carter's position with that of President Ford. Our general policy was that until we beat inflation into the ground, we weren't doing anything else. The Federal Reserve, by law independent of the White House, only seemed to mirror Carter's indecisiveness. My old mentor Arthur Burns and his successor, Bill Miller, kept trying to find a middle ground on monetary policy that would accommodate conflicting economic needs. They didn't want to make credit so easy as to further fuel inflation, but they didn't want to make it so tight as to choke the economy into another recession. From what I could see, that middle ground they were looking for didn't exist. But I was in the minority. To most people, the peril to the economy wasn't clear. There was a widespread feeling in Washington that since you couldn't bring down inflation without causing more unemployment, it wasn't worth the cost. Some on the right and on the left even began to argue that inflation, as high as, say, 6% a year, might be fine to live with. Like Brazil, we could index wages to take it into account. As any good economist could have predicted, Brazil later wound up with 5,000% inflation and a total economic collapse. This complacency even extended to Wall Street. You could see it most clearly in the bond market, which, while it gets far fewer headlines than its noisy cousin the stock market, is even larger. According to the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, the U.S. bond market in 1980 had a total value of $2.24 trillion versus $1.45 trillion for the stock market. At the end of 2006, those figures were $27.4 trillion and $21.6 trillion, respectively. The interest rates on 10-year Treasury notes, one of the best indicators of investors' long-term inflation expectations, climbed fairly steadily into the summer of 1979, but only modestly above where they were in 1975. This implied that investors were still betting that the American economy was inflation-resistant and that the problem would somehow just go away. The gas lines are what jolted everybody awake. The coming to power of Iran's Ayatollahs and the subsequent Iran-Iraq war cut oil production by millions of barrels a day, and the resulting shortages at the pump had a scary cascading effect. The cuts drove up oil prices enough to boost inflation still more, and the high prices further increased instability by putting the banks in the position of having to recycle even more petrodollars. The jump in inflation finally forced President Carter's hand. In July 1979, he shook up his cabinet and at the same time named Paul Volcker to replace Bill Miller as chairman of the Fed. In the years since I'd met Paul as a freshly minted Princeton graduate, he'd risen to become president of the New York Fed, the most important bank in the Federal Reserve System. Later, it emerged that until Carter appointed him, the president didn't even know who Volcker was. David Rockefeller and Wall Street banker Robert Roussa had urged him on the president as the necessary choice to reassure the financial world. Volcker captured the dark mood when he said at his swearing-in, "We are face to face with economic difficulties really unique to our experience. We have lost that euphoria that we had 15 years ago, that we knew all the answers to managing the economy." Volcker and I were not personal friends. At 6'7", with an ever-present cigar, he made a vivid impression, but in conversation I always found him quite introverted and withdrawn. He didn't play tennis or golf. Instead, he liked to go off by himself and fly fish. He was a bit of a mystery to me. Of course, Knowing how to play one's cards close to the vest is a strength in a central banker, and underneath that eccentric exterior, Paul clearly had tremendous force of character. Having been a civil servant most of his career, he didn't have much money. He kept his family at their house in suburban New York for the entire time he was Fed chairman. All he had in Washington was a tiny apartment. He invited me over once in the early 1980s to talk about the Mexican debt crisis, and the place was filled with piles of old newspapers and all the other clutter of a bachelor apartment. From the moment he was sworn in, Volcker knew that his job was, as he later said, to slay the inflationary dragon. He did not get much time to prepare. He'd been Fed chairman barely 2 months when a crisis erupted. Investors all over the world started dumping long-term bonds. The interest rate on 10-year Treasury notes leaped to nearly 11% on October 23rd. Suddenly, investors began to picture an oil-induced inflationary spiral leading to breakdowns in trade, a global recession, or even worse. All this started to happen while Volcker was at an IMF meeting in Belgrade, where he had gone to make a speech. He cut his trip short, much as I would do years later on Black Monday 1987, when the stock market crashed, and rushed back to convene an emergency Saturday morning meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee. What he masterminded that Saturday was arguably the most important change in economic policy in 50 years. The committee decided, on his urging, that it would no longer try to fine-tune the economy by focusing on short-term interest rates. Instead, it would clamp down on the amount of money available to the economy. The money supply, then measured by a statistic called M1, consists mostly of currency in circulation and demand deposits, such as checking accounts. When money expands faster than the totality of goods and services produced, in other words, when too many dollars chase too few goods, everybody's money tends to be worth less, that is, prices rise. The Fed could indirectly control the money supply by controlling the monetary base, mainly currency and bank reserves. Monetarists like the legendary Milton Friedman had long argued that until you contained the money supply, you hadn't tamed inflation. But the medicine required to do this was thought to be extremely harsh. No one knew how tight a rein on the monetary base would be required, or how high the associated rise in short-term interest rates would have to be before inflation was choked off. It would almost certainly mean more unemployment, probably a deep recession, and possibly a major outbreak of social unrest. President Carter backed Volcker in the spring of 1980, declaring inflation to be the nation's number one problem. That prompted Senator Ted Kennedy, then running against Carter for president, to complain that the administration wasn't paying enough attention to the poor or to tax cuts. By October, with the election drawing near, Carter himself had begun to hedge. He started talking about tax cuts and criticized the Fed for putting too many eggs in the basket of strict monetary policy. Doing what Volcker did took exceptional courage. I thought so at the time and believed it even more strongly after I became chairman myself. Though he and I rarely discussed his experience of those events, I can imagine how tough it was for him to push America into the brutal recession of the early 1980s. The consequences of his policy were even more severe than Volcker had expected. In April 1980, interest rates on Main Street USA climbed to more than 20%. Cars went unsold, houses went unbuilt, and millions of people lost their jobs. Unemployment rose to near 9% in mid-1980, on its way to near 11% by late 1982. Early in 1980, letters from people who'd been put out of work flooded Volcker's office. Builders sent him and other officials cut-up 2x4s to symbolize the houses they were unable to build. Car dealers sent keys to represent cars they hadn't sold. But by the middle of the year, after peaking at nearly 15%, inflation began gradually to decline. Long-term interest rates inched down, too. Still, it would take 3 years before inflation was fully in check. The economic misery, coupled with the Iranian hostage crisis, cost Jimmy Carter the 1980 election. Coming out of the Ford years, I was the ex officio senior Republican economist, the last who'd held high-level public office. So it was natural for me to get involved in Ronald Reagan's campaign. It made no difference that Ford and Reagan had competed 4 years earlier for the 1976 Republican nomination. My old friend and ally, Martin Anderson, joined the Reagan team. Marty had spent the post-Nixon years as a fellow at the Hoover Institution, and I resumed my old campaign role, too. Marty was chief domestic policy advisor, a full-time position on the campaign plane, and I was an unpaid, part-time consultant to the staff, much the same relationship I'd had to the Nixon campaign in 1968. I worked mainly from New York, but on occasion I'd fly out to spend a few days with the campaign. It was on one such trip, in late August, that I clumsily made what was probably my most important contribution to the election of Ronald Reagan. He had by this time already received the Republican nomination and had been stepping up his criticism of the Carter administration. Speaking at a Teamsters lunch in Ohio, he declared that working people's lives had been shattered by a new depression, the Carter Depression. This, of course, was technically incorrect. I'd written much of that speech, and the wording had been one of the major economic contractions in the last 50 years. Reagan had changed it on the fly. Marty Anderson and I took pains to explain to reporters that afternoon that the governor had misspoken. He had really meant to say a severe recession. Reagan thanked us for setting things straight, but he also stuck to his guns. When Democrats started challenging him on his mistake, he told reporters, "As far as I am concerned, the line between recession and depression cannot be measured in the strict economist's terms, but must be measured in human terms. When our working people, including those who are unemployed, must endure the worst misery since the 1930s, then I think we ought to recognize that they consider it a depression." I was impressed at how he'd been able to turn a mistake to his political advantage. I assumed this would be the end of the matter, but apparently the episode touched off an association in Reagan's memory. The following week, he added a new punchline to his stump speech. He started telling the crowds that the president was hiding behind a dictionary. "If it's a definition he wants, I'll give him one," Reagan would continue. "A recession